Coming up on Tech News Today, Barnes & Noble's last Nook gasp. Also, the U.S. Army shakes up the mobile market, and Square wants to take out Foursquare. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, May 3rd, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used Samsung Galaxy iPhone and other smartphones are worth at gazelle.com. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Aya Zaktar.
And for one final time, I am Boss Max, TJ, Alex Gumbel.
Alex, great. Round of applause for Alex Gumbel, everybody. Great job filling in for Jason Howell on maternity leave. Paternity leave, whatever you call it. Jason Dubeck on Monday, but Alex did a great job. We'll miss you, although we'll be very glad to have Jason back. Let's kick off the show with the top 10 stories of the day in the news feeds. Barnes & Noble Nook needs to do something to get back into the tablet wars, and they think that something is Google Play. Nook HD and HD Plus devices will now have access to the Google Play Store, making it more of a standard Android tablet and less like the Kindle Fire. The Play Store will come through a software update to users in the U.S. and U.K. starting today.
Acer has launched two new touchscreen notebooks and a tablet. One notebook, the Aspire R7, is a 15.6-inch touchscreen. Also has a hinge that allows users to rotate and flip the screen to convert into a tablet. The $1,000 product will be in stores in mid-May. Acer also unveiled the Acer Aspire P3 Ultrabook. That can be converted into a tablet. For $800, it's available now, as well as a 7.9-inch Acer Iconia A1 Android tablet that will retail starting in June for $169.
People of Shawnee, Kansas, the Google Fiber gods have looked down upon thee and will be granting you the power of gigabit internet. Shawnee is just outside of Kansas City, but the downside is Google didn't bother to mention when exactly that's going to happen.
Outlook.com now has 400 million active users thanks to Microsoft porting over all those Hotmail.com users. Yesterday, May 2nd, Microsoft announced the Hotmail Outlook transition was complete. Outlook.com had 60 million active users in February before the merging.
Google has hired Noah Falstein as chief game designer. Falstein comes from he's been in the business for quite a long time, since 1980. He's worked at companies like LucasArts, 3DO, and DreamWorks, Interactive, and is the designer behind a number of titles. He also ran his own consultancy business, the Inspiracy, which offered companies help on game design, development, and business.
Instagram just got a little Facebookier. Instagram just launched a new feature called Photos of You, which is a new profile section that lets you see photos where friends have tagged you with your username. You'll get push notifications when you're tagged. The feature first became available yesterday on Android and iOS.
Seattle's CoinLab has filed a lawsuit against Tokyo-based Bitcoin exchange Mt. Gox. The lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court for Western Washington alleges multiple counts of breach of contract and claims CoinLab suffered damages exceeding $75 million U.S. Mt. Gox announced in February that CoinLab would manage Mt. Gox's operations in the U.S. and Canada. Sounds like that didn't happen.
Good news for BlackBerry and Samsung. The U.S. Defense Department cleared devices from both companies for use by the military. BlackBerry 10 phones and tablets using Enterprise Service 10 will gain clearance, as well as Samsung's Android Knox. The Pentagon also is expected to clear Apple devices using iOS 6 sometime this month.
It's an old story. A creator wants to make popular content, so it borrows pieces of popular existing content and remixes them into their own thing. But then, brandishing intellectual property law, the popular content's owner comes striding in and files a federal lawsuit. Well, that's exactly what just happened to poor little Warner Brothers, who innocently used Nyan Cat and Keyboard Cat to promote the game Scribblenauts. And now they're being sued for copyright and trademark infringement by those media titans behind the two cat memes.
Defense Distributed, those folks who like to use 3D printers to make gun parts, just gave pictures of the world's first entirely 3D printed gun to Forbes. It's called the Liberator and is made up of 16 pieces that are printed in ABS plastic. One element inside the gun is not from a printer, and it's a 6-ounce piece of steel, which is there to comply with the Undetectable Firearms Act. Defense Distributed plans to release the CAD files for the Liberator in the coming weeks.
This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by our good friends at Gazelle. I have sold so many gadgets through Gazelle because it's simple. It's easy. I'm going through my old stuff and I'm like, you know what? I don't want to just throw this stuff away. I should at least properly recycle it, but wouldn't it be better to get some cash and also have somebody reuse it? That's why I use Gazelle, because I don't have to go to a lot of trouble to do it. I go online to gazelle.com. That's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. I tell Gazelle the condition of my gadget. They'll even buy broken iPhones and iPads. And then I get a risk-free offer for my gadget. Gazelle locks in that quote for 30 days. You don't need more than 30 days. And then after those 30 days are over, you'll get paid fast by check, PayPal, or Amazon gift card. You actually get 5% more when you choose the Amazon gift card. So go to gazelle.com now. Get an offer for your Samsung, your iPhone, your HTC, your BlackBerry smartphone, iPad, other Apple products. Do it today, because A, your gadget's probably not going to get more valuable over time. That's generally not what happens. And B, you got 30 days to go replace it or figure out how to get it back to them. Sometimes they'll even send you a box, free shipping for sure. So Samsung Galaxy S2, Samsung Galaxy S3, iPhone 4, iPhone 4S, iPad 3, whatever you got, Samsung, Android smartphones, go find out what they're worth. Take a minute and go to gazelle.com. Sell your used Samsung Galaxy or iPhone today at gazelle.com. I love them, and I thank them for supporting Tech News Today. Joining us now, because it's Friday and we always love to have Darren Kitchen in on a Friday. How are things going over there at Hack 5, Darren Kitchen?
Hey, things are going well. We're getting ready to hack across all the land.
I know. I can't. You're coming here in June. I'm looking forward to it. It's exciting.
June 22nd, LA. We've got, the 25th for Portland of this month, launching from Maker Faire on the 17th. There's all sorts of fun stuff going up the West Coast.
When you say launching from Maker Faire, I really want it to be like a catapult.
Yeah, I know, but it was a really expensive van, and I just don't feel like it would really like the suspension.
That's probably wise. Let's kick off the stories of the day with a little discussion about that change of heart by Barnes & Noble about the Nook and the Play Store.
Barnes & Noble announced it's bringing the Google Play Store to the Nook HD and the HD Plus, which brings over 700,000 apps to those tablets. Now, in the future, the Play Store will be preloaded on future devices. Barnes & Noble's own app stores will continue. They're not getting rid of those. And the two tablets will also be upgraded to use the Chrome browser, and we'll also get all the other Google suite of apps, including Gmail, YouTube, and Maps, since it now has Google Play. Darren, do you think this is enough to revive the Nook? It's just been kind of floundering for a while.
This really makes me wonder what is on Barnes & Noble's mind, because, I mean, obviously they have their own ecosystem, their own bookstore stuff, and so to allow in the Google Play stuff with their books and their movies and everything else, it just really makes me wonder, because it's not about the hardware to these companies. It's about getting you a device that's going to get you locked into their ecosystem. So if suddenly they're letting another ecosystem in, I don't know. It makes me wonder if they're just trying to get these Nooks off the shelf.
Tom, the Nook's got a heavily skinned version of Android, a lot like the Amazon version. But now this makes it a lot easier to have every single app you could possibly want on a Nook. Do you think this is going to get people's attention?
No, sadly, I don't see people saying suddenly, I am going to pay attention to the Barnes & Noble Nook in a way that I have never paid attention to it before because it has the Google Play Store. It's one of those things that I feel like I say this all the time. It's not a bad idea for Barnes & Noble at this point to just open things up, but maybe they should have done this from the first place, and I'm not sure it's too little too late.
So what do you think? Do you think it's too little too late? Do you think that if Nook had done this, or sorry, the Barnes & Noble has done this a long time ago, that the Nook would have been a serious competitor? Because right now, it's $199 for the 8-gigabyte model of the HD, $269 for the 16-gigabyte one, and The Verge called it slow and laggy. That's their HD Plus. That's their top-of-the-line one. Is there anything that Barnes & Noble can do?
Yeah, well, if you've got slow and laggy hardware, and it's certainly a crowded market, and for a while the Nook didn't have the Google Play Store, yeah, I think the odds are against the Nook at this point. I think this is the right move. you take out the whole conversation of, well, wait a second, what kind of apps does the Nook have that, or that, what are they missing that I could get on other Android devices, that sort of a thing. But now there has to be this whole conversation and sort of marketing push to educate people to say, oh, well, the Nook has all of these apps, a huge, huge plethora of apps. And yeah, I think that they probably should have done this at the get-go.
And when I was looking at the reviews.
I was going to ask if the Nook can still be a loss leader for Barnes & Noble if they also have the Play Store and somebody can go get any book reading app.
Well, maybe if that's Barnes & Noble plan, but I don't know if that could possibly work for them. I was looking at all the reviews for the Nook HD and HD Plus to see if this was the big differentiator. Was the App Store selection one of them? It was like one con on a couple of reviews, but because of the hardware quality and the software performance, that thing is not going to do well unless there's some kind of major firmware upgrade to make the Android part of it run better. It's one thing to have apps on it. Now that you have all this great app selection, if the actual operating system is slow and laggy and the touchscreen doesn't work very well, that's a larger problem than anything else.
Well, and Acer just dropped the bottom out of the tablet market with their $169 tablet announcement. So suddenly the Nook is now pricey, where it used to be, you know, at the
bottom of
the
market. Pricey's okay, but pricey and laggy don't mix.
Exactly. You do not want pricey and laggy. Did you see that Acer, the fact that they put the trackpad in behind the keyboard, by the way, on their all-in-one notebook thing there?
I did not see that yet.
No, that's weird. Let's talk about Samsung and BlackBerry devices opening up on the Department of Defense's approved list. Lieutenant Colonel Damian Pickert, or Lieutenant Colonel for those of you in the UK, announced that they have cleared at the Department of Defense BlackBerry 10 smartphones and BlackBerry Playbook tablets with Enterprise Service 10, along with Samsung devices that run Android Knox. He also mentioned they expect to clear iOS 6 devices sometime in the first half of this month, in early May. There are 600,000 smartphone users in the Department of Defense. 470,000 of them are BlackBerry. And then because of some pilot programs and some other situations, 41,000 are Apple users and 8,700 are Android. Phones have to have DISA approve the STIG, which only makes sense if you work at the Department of Defense. DISA is the Defense Information Systems Agency, and the STIG is not from Top Gear, but the Security Technical Implementation Guide. So there's a lot of paperwork you have to go through, which is why everybody has a BlackBerry, because previously, RIM was the only one that got their devices approved. Opening up devices, good or bad for the DoD, and how bad is it for BlackBerry? Either one of those questions, Taryn, what do you think?
Well, this actually isn't the very first time that BlackBerry's had, you know, this kind of encroachment on their domain. I mean, you know, STIG has been on the BlackBerry since BlackBerry OS 7. So, but the thing about this is, it's not just like you can say, oh, well, Android's good for the government, so go ahead and Android. No, it's on a device-by-device basis. And as I see here, the last one that was approved was in December of 2011, it was a Dell device, so that there's no wonder that they don't have, you know, and it's running what Android 2.2. So there's no wonder that that BlackBerry still has a foothold there. What the STIG means is that, you know, you can't access the Play Store, you can't do the Wi-Fi is locked down, all of your internet browsing goes through a DoD proxy. So I think this is good for anybody that wants a choice, but I don't think this is going to nip at BlackBerry's feet too much.
Well, I think BlackBerry, like you say, really benefited from having a virtual monopoly over these kinds of security situations. And this is a big crack in their armor at a time when they can't handle any kinds of cracks. Ayaz, how bad do you think this is?
For BlackBerry, I think this is a big problem, because what they had going forward was inertia. They were secure. This is where they were. And these are the types of people that should be using a BlackBerry device. But with Samsung up in the game and their security, and with Apple eventually getting security, that seems like it'd be really bad news for somebody like BlackBerry. And the thing is, though, this seems like it could be very helpful, since when you have a bunch of people working for a large organization and then they might want to start using their own personal devices, to offer up a little bit more choice, theoretically you can lock that down a little bit better, I would think, than it would be if you had two devices, a personal and a enterprise level one.
I can't imagine anybody. I'm sorry. I was just going to say that I can't imagine anybody in the military on one of these DoD networks risking their career putting their personal phone on one of those networks. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Sarah, what do you make? Do you have any different opinions about this? Any different take on this, or is it just like, you know what? This is good. We've got a competitive mobile marketplace, and it takes a while, but the effects are being shown at the DoD now.
Yeah, I think choice is good for anybody who wants to choose between the device that works best for them. I think this is probably a good thing for the DoD as well. I think BlackBerry is the company that loses here, just because BlackBerry has traditionally always been special. When you talk about high security workplaces, BlackBerry traditionally was the only system that was really trusted. So if it's opening up, well, that certainly hurts BlackBerry. Then again, I guess it can force BlackBerry to be that much better, get a leg up on Apple and Android, and make sure that everybody switches over. And that's not going to happen, actually. That was just a pie-in-the-sky idea for them.
It'll be interesting to see who ends up being preferred on the DoD network, assuming iOS 6 does get approved. Is it going to be the iPhone, or is it going to be Samsung Knox? Or is everyone going to say, look at this BlackBerry culture? We're used to that. System 10 is great. BlackBerry 10 is awesome. So that's what we're going to stick with. Square wants to take the 4 out of Foursquare.
Yeah.
See what it did there?
Yeah, so this is not anything that has happened yet. There's a really interesting story over at The Verge, though, about how Square's recommendation engine, which is actually already part of the app's merchant directory. Of course, for anybody who needs a little background, Square is the mobile payment app and service that has a pretty large merchant directory growing all the time, about 330,000 merchants that are already part of the directory, and has tripled its user base to 3 million since 2012. But the idea is that eventually Square will suggest places to visit based on your purchase history. And if that feature ends up working well, it could make the whole idea of checking in a thing of the past. Ajit Varma, who is the director of discovery over at Square, says, "We can tell you that people who like X might also like Y, because it's a true representation of what you've actually bought." Right now, payment data is recorded automatically. So if I go in and I buy a coffee, I don't actually have to take another step to say, hey, friends, I've checked in here, because the payment itself, the transaction that I would have to do anyway, becomes my check-in. So as far as Square is concerned, this is just a better way to do this. Payments made by a phone not only include what I bought, but information about where I am, what time of day it is, how much I spent, you know, how much I might be willing to spend on something comparable in the future, the frequency of which I might visit a particular location, that sort of thing. Then again, there are folks over at Foursquare who say, you know, there's nothing about a purchase that tells us whether you liked it or not. You may have, there may have been money that changed hands, but how social can something like Square be? Then you get into privacy issues, where are you really going to be making a social experience out of your payment history? Ayaz, what do you think? Do you think Square is onto something here, where they can create a very interesting history graph to help you discover stuff in the future?
I think if it's modifiable, if you can actually say, yeah, that this was the experience that I actually enjoyed when I was spending money at this, let's say, Acre Coffee. If I go to the coffee place, I like going there. They use Square. Let's have that as a record. But if I go to the DMV 3 times a week or something because something went wrong, I don't want to be suggested other government agencies you should visit because you've been at the DMV all week. So as long as it becomes something that's modifiable, I think that's really intriguing. But this idea of tracking your money and where you're spending it and seeing that you're spending a lot of money in this one location, I think that's actually a really intriguing idea when it comes to understanding how people's behavior works. Because I know a lot of people do a lot of drive-by Foursquare things, a lot of gaming the system of that. So why not have this kind of recommendation engine, which could be very, very, pertinent to each person?
Darren, Foursquare has, by and large, just because it's been around so long, the most check-in data and data of people's locations and where they've been. Square would have quite a bit of checking up, catching up to do, checking up, if it wanted to play on this level. But then again, they've got a mainstream retail partnership with Starbucks. This week, they actually hired Alex Petrov away from PayPal to become vice president of partnerships, which makes it sound like they're taking actual traditional retail partnerships a lot more seriously. Does this Does this make the idea of checking in just to check in a thing of the past?
I don't think it makes it a thing of the past. I just feel like it just adds a difference between the kind of waiting system. You may have seen online shopping sites that have verified buyers. So you know when you're reading a review that you know was somebody that bought whatever the widget is you're interested in. I think that they have a lot of potential there, especially considering they know how much you spent. So if it's like Starbucks and you spent $5, it's one thing. But if you're the guy that shows up every morning and spends $15, they know you're the office coffee boy or whatever have you. But so I feel like this just kind of increases the kind of weight that they have, but I don't feel like it would, you know, make the fad that is Foursquare and checking in disappear overnight.
Or Tom, do you think it could force an app like Foursquare to take more stock in actual transactions that occur? You know, right now Foursquare has partnerships with MasterCard and Visa. You see little specials pop up everywhere, but it's always sort of seemed to me like the places with the specials are places I don't really want to go. So they're trying to get me to come. This is a little bit more where I choose to go.
I feel like this is a game of capture the flag, right? And in the middle is winning the internet. But you've got Foursquare coming from the side of, hey, you can check in with us anywhere. And we've got partners with MasterCard, Visa, and American Express. You could pay with whatever you want, but you can't pay with our app. Otherwise, we're perfect. Square is saying, look, you just pay with Square and you're done. You don't have to check in. You don't have to do anything else. And then we'll be able to make pertinent recommendations so that you don't get crappy recommendations like Ayaz is afraid of, although we aren't accepted everywhere. So you can't do it every single place you go. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's the issue is like Square's got a pretty big disadvantage. I'd have to say advantage for Square right now. If I had to say.
Also disadvantage Square in that they have a whole bunch of other financial legal things that they need to, you know, maintain as far as regulations are concerned. Whereas since with Foursquare, you're opting into sharing your location and all of that other stuff, they have a lot less to worry about on the privacy side.
All right, let's talk about a study from Diffusion Group. I read about this in GigaOM today, that 14% of broadband household owners own a dedicated streaming box, something like an Apple TV or Roku, those sorts of things. They count on games consoles as well. That's up from 12% in 2011. So it's on the rise. But 25% of broadband households have a smart TV with an app platform. That's double the year before, up from 12% in 2011. Interestingly, only 69% of those smart TVs are actually connected to the internet in some way, whether it's wireless or Ethernet. The most popular internet TV device is a game console, whether it's an Xbox or a PlayStation. They didn't differentiate, but 62% of broadband households own one of those game consoles, and 25% of the time they spend on them is spent watching video. Now, we could say like, okay, well, maybe watching internet video is just slowing down, but it's not. Last fall, NPD said the television as your primary internet video screen rose from 33% to 45% year over year. So more TVs have the app platform, whether they're used or not, but set-top box growth is slowing. Even though people are watching more TV, this goes against all of our, you know, inside the beltway wisdom. But Ayaz, does this mean that smart TVs are actually doing better at getting people to watch internet video?
I seriously doubt that, because smart TVs, they're kind of, that's like saying so many TVs that are sold today are 16:9 and they're also HD and they have 3D. It's just something that's crammed into every television at this point. I know that there's a lot of people that just don't bother to use those apps on smart TVs because they are so slow. There's no reason to ever use those things unless you're in a bind. Additionally, a lot of people don't have wiring set up for that. Cheaper TVs don't have Wi-Fi. I'm thinking the reason why we're seeing a slowdown in set-top box adoption, I guess, is because once you have a game console in there, which you will connect anyway with either Wi-Fi or Ethernet, and then you find it has all these other video options, you're like, I'm going to start using this much more than I would anything else. And the internet video delivery system has gotten so much simpler with these little set-top boxes like Roku, Apple TV, and every game console that I think that's why we still have a lot of internet television watching, but it's not going to be through the actual television apps.
See, what I've been thinking is that these cheaper devices would win because they're cheaper and not everybody wants a game console. But this, what this shows is, at least right now, game consoles are winning. Darren, what do you think? Does that mean that game consoles will be the way people end up watching TV in the future?
Well, that's the thing. If you're going to connect one thing to your TV, getting a, you know, having a game console be the one connected to it makes perfect sense. If you're a gamer, you know, I don't think anybody that's like not interested in playing, you know, PS3 or Xbox 360 is going to run out and get one because they can watch Netflix or Hulu or YouTube on it. And ultimately, if, when it comes down to it, those are like the big things that people are doing with the kinds of set top boxes that are pretty much all kind of similar enough now. Whereas the integrated solutions, the smart TVs, have gotten so much better in the last few years. And I feel like there's a lot of potential there for them to bring internet content to people's homes that wouldn't have thought about going out and getting that geeky box that they have to, what's an HDMI cable, hook it up to their TV. And, you know, and to that, I just say that, you know, at one point in time, I used to have a PDA and a serial cable for my old Nokia. But, you know, now I have a smartphone. So it's just the integration of stuff, right?
I think you guys are both right. I think Ayaz is right that the fact of the matter is, you know, most people are just not going to hook up the Ethernet to their smart TV. The smart TVs are just, they just come. TVs come with smart TVs so often that people just buy it anyway, even though they don't care whether they're getting it. I also think you're right that there's a big market out there that won't adopt internet video if it's only available or best available through a game console. I think somebody still has to come into the market and come up with that cheap device that brings you everything, whether it's Intel or Amazon or Apple. They're all rumored or all trying, admittedly, in some cases, to do this. I think we'll still see that happen, but I think it'll then become a two-horse race. Do you get a game console or do you get this mythical future device that I'm talking about?
This mythical future device, Tom, you're just saying an inexpensive set-top box that does all the streaming video stuff?
Yeah, right. And non-gaming. I don't have to pay a subscription to use it. I only have to pay a subscription to channels on it. Let's talk about Yahoo, Ayaz. They've been snapping up all kinds of little devices, startups, app makers. What are they up to these days?
Yeah, so on Wednesday, Yahoo just acquired the to-do app Astrid. Now, that runs on the web and it has an Android app as well as an iOS app. But according to Pando Daily, Yahoo is getting ready to acquire another startup called Milewise. Now, Milewise calls itself Mint plus Kayak plus Miles, and the company has apps to give consumers the ability to figure out the travel rewards programs through iOS, Android, and its website. Sarah, we've seen Yahoo pick up a bunch of companies. They picked up Sumly. They've got Astrid. They tried to get Daily Motion, and that fell apart. Now this rumored Milewise deal. Are we starting to get a clearer picture of what Yahoo is going to turn into?
Well, I love the idea of Milewise. I think one of the things that I'm asking myself the most is, what's my incentive to maybe go with this airline? Or am I going to save a lot of money putting some sort of travel arrangement together? Can I use miles because I use a variety of airlines? So I love the idea of this. I will be interested in seeing how this is incorporated into the Yahoo experience. I mean, if you go to yahoo.com, at what point do you hop over to Milewise? But yeah, I mean, Yahoo is expanding rapidly, and Marissa Meyer said that she was going to do that from day one. She said they're interested in aggressively acquiring companies that work well for Yahoo's future. Yahoo wants to be a big player in the mobile space. They have a ways to go, but this is exactly what they should be doing. And again, for people like me, I look at this and go, great idea. I mean, if Yahoo owns Milewise and they don't screw it up, I think it's a great acquisition.
Tom, do you see any trends in these three together or a pattern? To me, it kind of looks like a productivity suite's being built up.
Yeah, I definitely see the idea being executed that Yahoo wants to become a consumer-focused, product-centric company. And these all fit into that. I'm not sure how they all fit in together, but productivity suite's not a bad way. I also don't think that means that Yahoo comes out with a productivity suite that they try to replace Office with. I think they want to be complementary. They just want to be where you live on the internet eventually. I don't know if they have their sites quite set on being like a Google Docs competitor, but maybe that's a longer term goal for them.
Darren, when I was looking at these Yahoo deals, when I saw the Daily Motion one being talked about for a while, it almost seemed like to me that Yahoo was trying to become Google again. That would be their YouTube. Since they didn't get that deal done, they have all of these other companies. What do you make of what's going on with the company?
Well, I mean, I look at Yahoo from the 90s and I'm like, okay, how would I define Yahoo in the 90s? And I'd say, well, they're those guys that kind of like have that ecosystem. They've got mail and news and weather and finance and all of those things. And then what happened between 1990 and 2010 was what? I mean, a lack of innovation. So I feel like maybe they're just playing some catch up and saying, you know what? Why don't we just buy some companies that do these awesome things? Because that's what we're known for, is having, you know, that whole experience.
Yeah, I'm wondering if Yahoo can put everything together. They used to do all kinds of search things. And if you can find all of the data you're talking about, of if it's integrated into your information such that it knows which credit card you should use to get the best rewards, if it knows your to-do list is with Astrid, if it knows what news stories you like with Sumly, if you can figure out all of these things together, I think Yahoo can possibly be putting together a really good, like, Google Now-style competitor, which could be really important for something like actually Apple, because Apple really seems to despise Google at this point, and Yahoo's been kind of working its way into iOS more and more. It could be a really long future plan.
All right, let's talk about Always On, not the show with Molly Wood, but the idea of having to have your game console always connected to the internet. Everybody hates that, but we have some numbers to look at. How many people really have a complaint, Sarah?
Yeah, we were talking about game consoles just a few minutes ago. It's rumored that the next version of the Xbox may have an Always On, I don't know if you'd call it functionality or hindrance, which has a lot of people up in arms, but NPD research firm surveyed 8,800 folks in February and March, found that 72% of U.S. gamers now play games online, which is up 5 percentage points from last year. The number of U.S. gamers who use a PC for online gaming fell by 4% over the past year to 68%. Now, PCs are still in first place, but mobile is catching up. And the number of people who said that they use mobile devices for online gaming rose 12% over the same period to 56%. Okay, well, let's go back to those 72% of U.S. gamers that say, yeah, that's how I play games. Darren, do you see this as, well, I mean, all the people naysaying about being always on, look at all these people who are only playing games online anyway. It's almost three quarters of those surveyed. Or does it still highlight that a good quarter of people still need the capability to not have an always-on connection?
I would say that, well, first of all, I'm trying to find the link to the study because I want to know, first off, if the study was done online or did they call people up? Because if it's an online survey about online gaming, I don't know.
It was an online survey.
Okay, well, then I think this is crap and you can pretty much ignore it, and any company would be stupid to ignore 30% of the nation that may not have the capabilities to do this. And I've said it before that it's one of those things where, I don't know, sometimes you have to put the cart, I sometimes think this is like putting the cart before the buggy, because, I don't know, it's like a chicken and egg thing where you need the rollout of broadband everywhere and the ubiquity and the affordability for always on gaming to be mass market. But at the same time, in perhaps not without that, will there be enough groundswell of people demanding that for that kind of change to happen? But I don't know. When you base your business model and your market on the availability of service from a telephone company or a communications provider, I think that's not a good bet.
When you look at these numbers of people who say that they use mobile devices for online gaming, rising 12% over a relatively short period of time, is this just people looking? Is this just if you have a company like Microsoft saying, yeah, that's the way that new Xbox is going to be, you're going to be mad at first, but you're going to get used to it. Is that them looking ahead to simply see these numbers growing and people getting used to the always on experience?
I think part of it, this trend with mobile, is the fact that these devices are always connected to a network. Even when your Wi-Fi is out, you probably have you have a backup system. You either have Verizon, T-Mobile, or whatever company behind you. So if that fails, that's a larger story usually. So the infrastructure is usually there. I think a lot of people are used to the concept of, when you get that game console, you figure out, how do I connect it to the internet? You don't want to just keep it as a game console, because you want to access all of the online content. There's internet content, downloading trailers, downloading game previews. You want to be able to do that because you don't want to run to a store and get a disc or something. That's silly. So I do understand that 30% right now might be thinking, yeah, I'm just going to play two-player games with my friends in the living room. But this is where this is going. This is like saying, oh, well, 100% of people have electricity. Eventually, all the gamers will be online all the time.
Tom Darren made a good point that if you can't get online to even participate in the survey, those people aren't being counted anyway. Does anyone care about the people who can't get online, or is that just one of those things that's going to separate two different markets?
Yeah, I'm looking at the press release now to see if there's any hint, because I'm trying to imagine, like, NPD is actually a very respectable survey organization, and they run very statistically reliable surveys usually. That also doesn't change the fact that Darren's right. If you only survey online people, you've got a selection bias you have to account for there if you're asking if they game offline. And I can't get to the study because I haven't paid for it. But according to the methodology, as you already reported, the survey was completed by 8,867 individuals from the NPD's online panel. So my question would be, did they then weight the percentages to say, okay, this percentage of the U.S. audience we know doesn't have internet access but also plays video games, and let's change the percentage and just assume, let's just factor that in. They may have done that, in which case this study is still valuable. But it's definitely a fair question to ask, because if you only ask people who are online if they game online, well, you're going to get a higher number. I would like to know that particular instance. Either way, I don't think it matters. Even if 100% of the people said we do play games online, they're still going to complain. They're still going to say, but I don't want to have to. I don't want to. Mm-hmm. I want to be able, if the internet is out, to play my video games. I still think that's a valid
question. I'm starting to wonder if online gamers or offline gamers are starting to turn into people who fix their own cars or people who update their own PCs, that it's a smaller and smaller class as time continues, because the big manufacturers are saying, no, the general consumer doesn't care about this. So I'm just wondering if this is just a part of this niche audience that's just getting smaller and smaller as time goes on.
I would just say that if someone tweets in the forest without any 3G data service, does it make a noise? And yeah. I would sum that up by just saying SimCity 5.
Makes that noise. Let's talk about bees instead in the randomizer. Because then we could talk about the birds and the robot bees. Harvard University RoboBee Project has actually made what I consider to be robot flies, because they base the wings on flies. But still, pretty amazing. They've got MEMS, microelectromechanical motors, that work as pop-ups. So they print out this board to create the mechanical fly, and then they essentially use the same principle behind pop-up books to pop up everything so that it's easily assembled in exactly the right way. And they get these tiny robotic flies that use piezoelectric engines to run. You just a piezoelectric actuator, which are strings of ceramic that expand and contract when the electric field is applied, allow these things to fly. And the wings are based off of actual insects, actual flies, and they work.
So flat-packed flies?
Yeah, these are going to be great at IKEA.
Yeah, I was about to say.
There's your coffee table? Right here. That's just, it's so bizarre to watch the video of it actually come into being. It does look like a pop-up book happening, but they're printing these out, right, Tom?
Yeah, exactly. They print them out as flat boards. They're about the size of a penny. And those of you saying, this has been around for a few years, it's not. This is a brand new peer-reviewed revelation from a Harvard project. There have been similar projects in various stages of success, but nobody's been able to do what these guys have done yet. So go take a look at the video and you'll see what I mean about. Really, the big thing isn't just that they made a little robot piezoelectric fly. It's the way that they made it so that you can easily repeat building these things. It took the tedium out of them, which is another step down the road to mass production.
I love it when machinery mimics nature, especially in aviation. This is so cool.
Let's see what's on the calendar.
We have lots of themed days. Today is actually International Day Against DRM. Yes, May 3rd, 2013. Rage against DRM. Rage against the dying of the DRM. Free comic book day is tomorrow. Yay!
No DRM on comic books.
I know who's going to love that. Ron Richards, one of the co-hosts of All About Android. He always celebrates free comic book day. Quite a few comic books.
By stealing comic books.
Well, they're free, so it's...
Every day is free comic book day.
It's one day where you don't have to steal. It's because they're free anyway. And then Sunday is Cinco de Mayo, also known as May 5th, where people sometimes celebrate in a party kind of a way. So if you do that, be festive and also safe.
It's really like St. Patrick's Day, except in Spanish.
Yes.
Because it's celebrated a lot
more. It's St. Patrick's Day with more margaritas.
It's celebrated a lot more in the United States than it is in its supposedly originating country. But yeah, hey, excuse for a margarita, I'm in. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Let's also see what's incoming, shall we?
Incoming message.
Sure. We got a message from Alex. He says, "Hey, TNT crew, I'd like to share a simple observation with you that I've come to over the past several days. I recently upgraded my smartphone from my old faithful iPhone 4 to a brand new Samsung Galaxy S4. The hardware and feature set upgrade was phenomenal. The 1080p screen is much higher fidelity. The 4G network is much faster. As a piece of hardware, this is the greatest smartphone I've ever held in my hand, even if the plastic back is disparaged by most reviewers. Tomorrow, I will be returning it for a full refund. Why? Because even though it's a better phone, I simply do not get enough added utility out of it. Everything I need from a mobile device is handled perfectly well by the nearly 3-year-old iPhone. It's not as though I'm not a tech-savvy person either. I'm rather impressed by the fact that the S4 has around the same CPU base clock and RAM capacity as the budget laptop I took to college in 2007. Given that smartphone market continues to grow as more and more users ditch their feature phones, how much longer do you think we'll wait before the smartphone market starts to look like the PC market now, one where consumers will extend their upgrade cycle by several years as the devices they have currently suit all their computing needs?" It's a pretty intriguing.
7 years and 6 months. That's my guess.
That's your guess? Darren, do you have a time table there?
I would say I don't think that's going to happen overnight, just because unlike a computer or, you know, a desktop or a laptop, the phone that's in your pocket gets a lot more abuse. But yeah, I mean, it will definitely slow down.
So Darren says not overnight. Tom said 7 years and six something or other. Sarah, what do you got?
I don't know. I don't even think it'll take 7 years. I think that we've seen with the phablet market, which is, you know, a stupid name, but it's actually something where more and more people sort of go, you know what, this actually works for me because it's small, but not too small and not too big and very mobile. I'll say five years.
I was going to say five as well.
You just November 3rd,
took it right out of your mouth.
I'll say 6 years now. That's what I'll say.
Yeah. November 3rd, 2020. Many people in the chat room pointing out that May the 4th is also the Star Wars thing. May the 4th be with you.
I was hoping we were going to ditch that since we didn't have a show tomorrow.
Yeah, so we were actually just going to
gloss over that.
It's a rebel plot anyway, so ignore it.
It's also the Kentucky Derby.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Horses.
And two of the horses have the word kitten in their names.
Oh, wow. Which one do you vote for?
Nyan Cat and Keyboard Cat?
No,
one will place and one will show.
One is named Charming Kitten and one is named Fear the Kitten.
Wow, this is a packed weekend. So you can have your mint julep on Saturday your margarita on Sunday.
Yeah.
I know my plans. Well, that is it for us. Darren Kitchen, Hack Across America, beginning soon. What are you doing now, between now and then?
So all you have to do is go over to hackacrossamerica.com. You're going to find the map and the calendar and all of those things. And if I'm going your way, sign up. You don't have to have a hackerspace to sign up. If you just want to be part of meetups, go ahead and get up in there. And just stay tuned because I'm going to be doing lots of video blogs and all sorts of other fun stuff from the road. So I'll see you there from hackacrossamerica.com.
If you, like Lenny Kravitz, want to know, are you going to go my way? Go to hackacrossamerica.com. Also, it is Friday, which means that I want to remind you of our best of, twit.tv/best of, any show on the Twit Network. If you see a moment you're like, that needs to be saved for the end of the year special where they show all the best moments of the year, go to twit.tv/best of and tell us all about it. Of course, you can always find us in our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com. It's an essential way we decide what stories are going to go into the lineup each and every day. Not the only way, but an essential way. So get in there and at least do some voting, if not submitting some stories at technewstoday.reddit.com. Big thanks again to Alex Gumpel and Chad Johnson, who filled in on Mondays for filling in for Jason Howell, who will be back with us on Monday. You can find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. You can email us. Our email address is TNT@twit.tv. And give us a call. Leave us a voicemail. Our phone number is 260-TNT-SHOW. On Monday, we'll be joined by Tom Krazit from GigaOM. See you then.